This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Thursday, October 10th, 2019. I'm Caleb Brown. States house most inmates and handle the vast majority of criminal cases, and criminal justice reform at the state level continues to be a bit of a mixed bag. Robert Ault surveyed state-level criminal justice reforms of 2018 for the Federalist Society. During Cato's Constitution Day festivities, we talked about how states have changed laws regarding marijuana, bail, and other parts of the criminal code.
Most states have ended long ago their legislative sessions. What has been, at least so far, the movement on criminal justice reform at the state level?
Well, we actually went ahead and did a large white paper for the Federalist Society looking at trends in 2018, what happened both in terms of prosecution and defense-friendly policies. And the interesting thing is, I think, as an overview, if you take a look at what's happened in the states, it didn't necessarily trend in just one direction, either pro-defense or pro-enforcement. Indeed, they didn't even necessarily trend in the same direction in the same state. So let me give you Ohio as an example, my home state, and a state that's done a ton on criminal justice reform. Last year, they passed some of the most pro-reform legislation in the country, including allowing defendants to expunge their records if they have been found to be victims of human trafficking, requiring courts to consider drug treatment or rehab in felony sentencing, expanding local community-based corrections facilities and allowing more people to have criminal charges dropped after completing drug treatment programs, reinstating indefinite sentencing for some felonies. But Ohio also passed strong pro-prosecution legislation, including creating a violent offender registry and enhancing penalties for trafficking fentanyl. So even within the same state, you know, you've got trends going in both directions. I'd say looking across the country, there were a couple of big areas of movement last year. The first was in drug policy, and I'd say that you saw a continuation of the trend toward liberalization of marijuana policy. Two states, Vermont and Michigan, decriminalized possession and use of recreational marijuana. And I think it's worth noting at the outset that these two states share something in common. They border Canada. Canada became only the second country in the world to legalize pot effective October of last year. And this seemed to have quite a bit of effect with regard to the decision-making in both Michigan and Vermont. Michigan passed their legalization initiative by a ballot initiative. And the passage, having talked to some folks, it took quite a bit for, a good citizen of Ohio to chat with folks in that state up north, as Woody Hayes used to call them. But chatting with folks about the election, a lot of them, felt like the legalization in Canada, it was going to lead to folks going across the border to purchase, perhaps coming back either with the product or on the product. And they just decided it would be better to actually legalize and have it more uniform in terms of how it was applied. Vermont is interesting because it was the first state to legalize recreational marijuana via legislation rather than by ballot initiative. And I think that this probably says something about the shift in public sentiment, where politicians do not see this as a dangerous or a hard vote. I mean, before, this has been a question that, was left to you get it on the ballot and, you sort of allow the popular vote to take it. So I think it's kind of a big shift in that sense. But the real canary in the coal mine probably, in terms of the policy shift, I'd say, is Michigan. This is really the first Rust Belt state to have legalized recreational marijuana. Before this, you're dealing with, sort of coastal states and Rocky Mountain High, Colorado. But
it was not the first state that I predicted would go green, as it were.
No.
It's Midwestern state, that is.
Exactly. And after that, and my prediction when that happened is that afterward you would begin to see other states. So Illinois this year legalized recreational. New York State, again, largely seemingly motivated by Canada, has legalized, I think, beginning effective next year. And to my mind, there's been this tension for some time between the federal government and the states on this. The federal government still has marijuana as a Schedule I. illegal drug. They've gone and executed a policy of discretionary non-enforcement, which they've made clear they can go ahead and change track on at any given time. My guess is that Michigan might be the Uber moment, you know, which is to say Uber had this sort of business model, at least at one point, of going into jurisdictions and not asking permission. They just went ahead and, you know, sort of created a demand for their product. And at a, you know, in some jurisdictions, they tried to clamp down on it and prevent it. But at a certain point, it became too difficult. The public demand, you know, there was a public shift and they sort of jumped past the regulators on it. I wonder whether or not Michigan is sort of the indication of that, which is to say, previous to that, you could have seen perhaps a shift back towards an enforcement policy by the federal government in those jurisdictions that had chosen to legalize at a state level. I think at this point it becomes increasingly difficult. You've perhaps hit a tipping point.
How much did those two legalizations, that is Michigan and Illinois, how much did those have to do with those states being broke?
I'm sure the tax revenue certainly had something to do with it. But I think in the long run, it'll be interesting to see. It is going to take some federal action at some point to get the banking questions figured out. I mean, I was on a panel with the Solicitor General of Colorado a number of years ago when he talked about the fact that the dispensaries in Colorado, when they were paying their state tax bills, did so by bringing suitcases of cash into, you know, the treasurer's office because, again, you know, they essentially could not do business with the banks. Now, there's been, again, a discretionary non-enforcement policy applied to the banking industry, but given the strictures, there's a number of requirements that are placed upon banks that choose to do business with cannabis businesses that require a huge amount of oversight responsibility by the banks. There are still precious few banks that take that risk.
With respect to prison populations and marijuana, is there much benefit in terms of jail cells freed up at the state level? Are states moving to retroactively commute sentences that are related to the laws that they've passed?
Some states have looked at retroactive modification, not all. My sense is it hasn't had a huge impact with regard to populations, just perhaps jail, less so prison. Most of those, you have to be a fairly large trafficker in order to get significant prison time for marijuana in most states. There are a couple of other things that were interesting looking at legalization of medical marijuana. Utah and Missouri legalized medical marijuana. And again, of those, spin off your comment, Utah is not the first state I would have, you know, sort of picked out to have gone toward legalization, even on medical marijuana. And again, I just think that this goes to the larger trend. At this point, if you've got a state that's as deep red as Utah passing something like medical marijuana, I just think, again, this is whether you're for or against legalization, I just think that at this point, this is a genie that's probably not going back in the bottle.
Issue, civil asset forfeiture, civil forfeiture reform was popular in a variety of states, according to your look here. Wisconsin, Wyoming, New Hampshire, Idaho, Kansas, Virginia, Tennessee. What has driven so many states to make a change there? Of course, forfeiture is strongly related to the drug war, but why did these states move on that issue? How did they move?
More than half a dozen states passed some kind of civil asset forfeiture reform. I think this is something that has really been the result of messaging by the free market movement. I'll give an immense amount of credit to the Institute for Justice for, you know, who's made civil asset forfeiture a priority for years. The Buckeye Institute, we actually had passed civil asset forfeiture previously in Ohio and was heavily involved in that. Cato obviously has been an aggressive defender of
since the
property 90s. Rights. So, you know, this is one of those ones where I think the free market movement has made a massive impact, part of it by being able to tell the stories of individuals and provide real world examples. When we were talking about civil asset forfeiture in Ohio, one of the stories that was particularly powerful was that of a small business owner in the Cleveland area, Jennifer, who ran a small business. She had a beauty salon in an area of town that was fundamentally unbanked. The people there didn't have bank accounts. They paid her in cash. And so as she would leave at the end of the day, after working a long day, she would have, the proceeds from her business in the day all in cash. Unfortunately, some of the local officers knew something that probably a fair number of your listeners don't, which is that over 90% of U.S. currency has traces of narcotics on it. And so when she got pulled over, they would ask, because this was an area where there was drug trafficking going on, did she have cash on her? When she said, honestly, yes, from my business, they would call for a drug dog. The drug dog would alert because, as I just mentioned, 90% of U.S. currency has traces of narcotics on it, and they would seize her legitimately earned cash. She went and talked to a lawyer. There's got to be something I can do. This was, lawfully gotten, gains. I need this to support my family. Only to be told, no, there's really not a whole lot you can do. Because this is a civil action, you don't have a right to counsel. And so if you can go ahead and retain me, and but by the time you pay my hourly fees and so forth to fight this, given the standard of review, you're going to pay more to get your money back than what was seized. And so for a period of time, she realized that she had to pay essentially for this graft as the cost of doing business. Examples like that, I think, painted a vivid picture and really, I think, was the impetus for the types of reform that you're saying.
It seems like a lot of states did pretty dramatically different things, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Now, you've got, some states simply did some transparency measures to demonstrate, sort of shine a brighter light on what was going on. States like Wisconsin, for instance, that was the 15th state to require criminal conviction before the state may seize any personal assets. And, I think that's, sort of the gold standard, what you're looking for in these sorts of cases. The trend has continued this year as well. Michigan and Arkansas signed civil asset forfeiture reforms that require criminal convictions in many cases in order for the state to seize assets.
Bail reform has been something that really seems to have only bubbled up in the last 2 or 3 years as a really substantial issue, or at least an issue where there was some movement. Why is that? Am I right to believe that? And if so, why is that?
I think part of it, this is an area where, in part, technology has allowed improvements, which is to say, I think for a long time, we knew there were issues with cash bail, and cash bail was kind of a clunky tool that we used. And let me take a step back and, sort of explain some of the basics of bail, which is to say, okay, you've been charged with a crime, but you've not been convicted of the crime. So we can't, the government cannot punish you. It's impermissible for them to house you in a jail as punishment for that crime. The Supreme Court has said it's much unconstitutional for them to do so. So there's a couple of reasons that they can hold you. They can hold you to make sure that you actually show up for trial, or they can hold you for public safety reasons because you're a threat to yourself or to society. And we use at times cash bail as a proxy with regard to those ends, either getting you to show up because you would forfeit your bail bond if you don't show up, and I've never entirely understood the justification behind the use of cash bail in order to protect public safety, because we've actually, at Buckeye, for instance, shown how individuals have been able to post very high cash bonds and then gone out and committed horrific crimes. It doesn't necessarily seem that your ability to actually pay a cash bond has any, sort of high correlation in terms or cause, certainly no causation in terms of your being a safer citizen in society.
Right. Your level of wealth does not predict the risk you pose to society.
Exactly. So, but recent technologies have allowed us to do a few things. I mean, one, you know, we can, if we're releasing you and we want to keep track of you, you know, you and you, you know, perhaps we, you know, we're not quite willing to say you're going to be completely released on your own recognizance and we're going to have no ability to track you. We can, you know, use a GPS tracking device in order to keep tabs on you without simply locking you up and depriving you of your ability to actually, you know, continue working in your job. So that technology has helped. The other thing is the development of what are called risk assessment tools, you know, where you use in some sense some of the some big data to take a look at factors and try and make better determinations as to whether or not they're public safety concerns.
Well, and the for the defendants being in jail for 3 days where you are not able to post a bond, you can lose your job. I mean, the disruptions to your life in a very short period of time, assuming you don't pose some risk to society or yourself, are extremely punitive.
The studies on this are extraordinarily clear. Even, you know, even 2 to 3 days in jail has massive impacts on individuals' lives. And, you know, the number of individuals who lose their jobs, who then have trouble finding another job, even if they're ultimately not convicted, it has long-term consequences on their financial well-being and their ability to be a productive member of society. So the more that we can actually keep folks, you know, in positions where they can keep their jobs, where they can stay in the community, and where the municipality isn't paying, or the state, depending on, you know, who's paying the tab on housing them, isn't paying to keep them in jail, it's far more cost effective. We've done a number of experiments in Ohio. We began in Lucas County around Toledo, then in Summit County, and the answer is the results were phenomenal. Saved millions of dollars to the locality. More people actually showed up to trial than before in terms of the percentage rates, and fewer crimes committed by people who were released pre-trial. So by using risk assessment tools, we're able to achieve the objectives. And you don't have the outrageous cases like we had out of Dayton a few years back when you had a kid who was arrested for, in this particular case, it was violating the dress code on the city bus, which, again, I didn't even know that there were dress codes on the city bus, but apparently he violated it. He was put into jail. It took 9 days, I believe, for his mother to come up with the $500 to post bail for him, which she did by getting a title loan on her vehicle. Now, you know, say what you will, this individual who had no priors did not, you know, the violation of the dress code does not suggest in any way to me that he's a grave danger to society. And yet you locked him up for 9 days, over $500, when, again, if you were using risk assessment tools or something of the like, it seems like we could have solved this much easier at a much lower cost to the community and far less disruptive to this individual's life.
So in 2020, on a lot of these issues, do states feel like, this was our bite at the apple. We did it. Now, you people who are very concerned about this issue, we have placated you. Please go away. Or is this, in your view, something that will broaden, where states are more serious about criminal justice reform?
I think this is a continuing trend that you're going to see. Two states last year initiated a fairly substantial reform. California passed cash bail reform, which required the use of risk assessments conducted by an agency of the pretrial assessment services. It created a presumption that the court will release defendants on their own recognizance at arraignment with the least restrictive non-monetary conditions that will reasonably assure public safety and the defendant's return to court. So pretty strong bail reform there. New Hampshire also passed bail reform, which revised bail to require, among other things, that a court shall not impose a financial condition that will result in the pretrial detention of a person solely as a result of that financial condition. But I tend to think this is an issue. I'll tell you, in Ohio, we had a commission that was set up by the state Supreme Court that has recommended modifying the rule, the bail rule set by the court, and those are set to go up for modification this next year, and there's probably going to be legislation that follows along with that. So I think this is something that I think you're going to continue seeing. As you continue to see refinement of these risk assessment tools, I think the one knock by some folks in the ACLU and others is whether or not there's racially disparate impact with regard to some of these tools. I think that the key is transparency, and a number of them actually are relatively transparent in the factors that they consider. But the other thing is, I think that like any sort of tool like this, I think they'll get better over time as more and more data is brought into play and more jurisdictions adopt them. But in any event, I think the answer is keeping with the current system, which I think has pretty serious racially disparate effects and can be devastating to folks like, the kid in Dayton who spent 9 days in jail over a petty infraction. Those effects are absolutely devastating to individuals.
Robert Ault is president of the Buckeye Institute in Ohio. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.